I think when art is at its edgiest, system-changey best, it's holding up a mirror to the absurdity of the current way of doing things, confronting people with that reality. When we change how we feel, then it can start to change how we think, and that can start to change how we act.
Welcome to Express Change, a podcast about art and activism.
Right now, we're treating people and the planet like they're here to serve the economy, when really it should be the other way around. What will it take for us to reimagine and remake our economies to deliver social justice on a healthy planet? We're part of a global movement that's trying to do just that.
There's a popular saying, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Our cultural mainstream hardly ever imagines what a different system could look like. We want to find out how new and innovative art can help us change our view on politics, economics, the world, and our fate.
To get to these answers, we'll talk to artists and creatives from a wide range of fields, backgrounds, and parts of the world. I am Marina Gattas, Culture and Public Policy Lead at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, based in São Paulo, Brazil.
And I am Martin Oetting, an artist and writer based in Berlin, Germany. Thank you so much for listening. This is episode 5 of Express Change.
Today we're speaking with political economist, writer, and advocate for economic systems change, Dr. Catherine Trebek. She is a co-founder of the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, as well as its Scottish hub. She is now back to her home country, Australia, working on so many different projects. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you.
I'm imagining you're meeting someone new, someone who hasn't heard of you, someone who doesn't know your work. You get introduced and that person says, so Catherine, what do you do? How do you answer that question?
It's hard, actually, because it isn't, you know, there isn't one single thing I do. The easiest way to answer is, well, I rant a little bit about the way the economy operates, and I write and I speak about ways to hopefully make it a little bit better on people and better on the planet, and sort of try to help, I don't know, whoever may listen or not, just maybe think about the economy in a slightly different way and push the cause for economic system change.
What role does art play in your life?
I appreciate art in all sorts of different mediums of art, whether that's music or dance. If someone was to wave a magic wand and give me some sort of artistic skills, I would love to be a sculptor. If I could spend a day wandering sculpture parks, that's the sort of mode of art I most love. I have no knowledge of art. It's just sort of like my knowledge of wine. I know what I like and what I don't. So I do use art professionally quite a bit as a communication aid, and particularly cartoons, because they're so clever in crystallizing an issue in just a brilliant way that helps audiences grasp a concept in ways that sort of long words or charts or bullet points on a PowerPoint can't. I mean, I've got loads of favorites actually, but there's one I'm using a lot recently, and it's a cartoon of a little koala in a forest that's been logged. So there's just, all you see is a ton of tree stumps, and this little koala is holding onto one of the tree stumps, and you can see he's shaking because they've got little jaggedy lines around him. So he's shaking, and there's two people that look like sort of professionals, I guess. And just one of them says, this koala has a mental health problem. It really, to me, captures often the sort of individualization agenda that you see in a lot of policy, putting the onus of responsibility and onus of change on the individual rather than looking at the circumstances. And I think that's where the work that a lot of us do, where we're saying, yeah, but look at the circumstances. What's a prescription from someone who thinks that koala has mental health problems? Yeah, some treatment, some therapy. And yes, that would probably help in the short term, but it's not addressing the root causes. So a cartoon like that enables me to then have a conversation around where the economic system and the policy discussion is landing. And there are so many other other cartoonists whose work I really love and admire. So in a professional sense, art is a communication aid to me. I mean, there's a ton of other art, some of those incredible installations. So there was a really famous one called something like World Leaders Talking About Climate Change, and their heads are almost submerged underwater. Those sorts of very powerful ones that just show the absurdity of some of the situations, I think, is really such an important role for art as well.
I went to Madrid to visit some friends, and at the Reina Sofia, they had an exhibit called the Economía del Malestar, so like the malbeing economy. And in it, there was this cartoonist. He's called Alfredo Ezefron, something like that. Basically, it's all cartoons critiquing the current financial system. If you take a step back, could you speak a little bit about what your, I guess, personal philosophy is in how economic systems change can happen and what role arts play in shifting or impacting how people are thinking about it and those mindsets?
You know, Marie, it's a really fascinating question because I don't think of all the sort of Q&A and discussion I get in different podcasts or different webinars or different sort of presentations I've been doing, I don't think anyone has asked me the question in that way of what's my personal philosophy. I have a view on how change happens generally, and I'm still really wrestling with what's my role in that. You know, what's the cog in the whole crazy system that I might bring to it? And also, to be really, really honest, I'm really not sure at the moment how we, and I use that word really carefully when I to describe the economic system change movement in this context, how the economic system change movement is going to galvanize enough change to change the economy. It's something it's very, very live with me at the moment around, have the strategies and tactics and approaches of the movement been good enough? Have they been effective enough? And I think it's very hard not to look around the state of play in the world and the extent of polarization and the sort of trends of, you know, a lot of right-wing, even fascist politicians in parliaments around the world. And it's very hard actually to think that the tactics thus far are proving adequate. And so in terms of, yeah, how to go about approaching change, I mean, I think we need to enormously interrogate what has worked and what hasn't been effective thus far. And I think the big question I'm grappling with myself is, and this is the sort of thing that keeps me awake at night, is how does the movement build a groundswell that is big enough to get politicians to stare down the backlash for the changes that need to be made to our economy? There will be a backlash to even the most tentative progressive moves. The big thing we need now is politicians who are prepared to stare down that backlash. And so how do you do that is you need enough people around them to make them feel bold enough to stand their ground when they get the crazy press. And I mean, I'm here in Australia where the power of the Murdoch press is extraordinary, utterly extraordinary. And so, you know, you need politicians prepared to, you know, push back on that and, you know, keep going in the face of that. And I think that does require that this movement builds that groundswell. And I think art probably, in all senses of the term, is probably an element that hasn't been utilized or appreciated enough, particularly in terms of reaching out to audiences that are never going to come to policy webinars or read nice policy documents on, you know, think tanks' websites or sign up to newsletters from We All. Where I sit at the moment, it's down the road for me, there's a massive, massive hospital being built. And the tradies, as they call them in Australia, people building that who walk down that way every morning between about before 6 a.m. right up to after 9 a.m. So they're all walking down there with their hard hats on, with their high vis. And then from about 3:30, they start walking backwards. And I sit here at my desk seeing that procession of folks who are there building this amazing hospital. And it's incredible because I've seen the progress of this hospital over the last few months, thinking, how do I speak to those people? And it probably won't be me speaking to them, but what will they listen to? Is it, you know, is it the sort of songs like, you know, Bruce Springsteen in the 80s, you know, that reached out to working class communities? Is it, you know, cartoons? Is it TikTok? I don't know, but I think we need different messengers, and it's not going to be me. What are the messengers to take the messages to that wider audience, to build that groundswell, to give politicians the basis on which to stare down the inevitable backlash?
I have a very selective, weird memory. There are some things that I can't believe I forget. And then there's other things that stay with me all my life. And one of those things that stayed with me was when you told me, and I don't know when this was, that Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged had this pivotal role in the development of neoliberal thought and is still a Bible to many of that school, of that way of thinking, and that no equivalent exists for what we're trying to do. That sentence of yours, or that explanation or that statement of yours, is still my North Star in a way. A piece of writing, a book, which is a fictionalized, you know, a fictional story, can have that kind of an impact. And I'm still, you know, wondering, like, what's that look like for what we're trying to do?
One of the legacies of that novel is the Atlas Network, which is this sort of quite sinister network of folks and I think corporates, you know, promoting a very particular way of seeing the world as well, and, you know, spending money and supporting think tanks and so on. So, you know, its legacy, you know, ripples on today. The other thing I've been reading recently I heard about this many, many years ago, but dug into it a bit recently, is in the UK in the early 80s, there was a comedy series that was played here in Australia. And I remember every Sunday night, my parents watching it. And it was sort of a routine for us on a Sunday night where we'd sit down with our cheese on toast and blankets over our legs and watch this sitcom called Yes Minister. And then there was Yes Prime Minister. One of the writers of that was very, very big player in the Tory party, in the Conservative Party in the UK. And you think about what is the subtle message of that TV series, Yes Minister? It's that the elected officials are hopeless and dithering and bit dappy. And then the all-powerful bureaucrat stops everything. And so it seeds in this sort of like this zeitgeist in your mind, this sort of incompetent, obstructive government as well. And of course, you know, in the 80s in the UK, this is Thatcher's era, where she really mounted this campaign to basically to slag off government. And then, of course, people, you know, of that era going into their professional jobs and their careers, taking that mindset that's been seeded to them on their Sunday nights, having their cheese on toast at home. It's very powerful. Just thinking of, you know, what are the movies or books that have come close or even at least attempting to this? And I think most recently, one of the most sort of bigger efforts was Don't Look Up. And then perhaps a few years before that, I think it was called Shrinkification. And then there was another one around the Joneses, around consumerism, and The Day After Tomorrow, this sort of dystopian sort of climate breakdown film, which now seems all too real, what we're seeing on our nightly news. So it's not as if there haven't been attempts, of course, but you're right. Nothing seems to have had that incredible power on its own that Atlas Shrugged had.
Imagine you were in a room full of artists of all kinds and shapes and sizes and types, and you were to speak to them about what you would expect from them. I think we can formulate an expectation, you know, given the state of the world. And let's say there's these people who say, I want to provide my, I don't know if I want to say services, because then it sounds like they're becoming an advertising agency, which is not what this is about, but I want to provide my craft and my art.
I think, I mean, there's two levels to my off the top of my head reaction to that. And one is a really practical level, is the movement will need to find a way to support artists financially if in that incredible gift that you're describing in that conversation, because so often I think artists, you know, get asked to chip into these sorts of projects for free. I've just been invited to join a conversation around a basic income for artists from a project in Scotland. And I'm really looking forward to that, to sort of really try to learn, you know, some novel ways of remuneration. So making sure that artists can earn a living, to make this a viable livelihood for artists who are maybe going to be part of the wellbeing economy movement. the next question is, I would probably want to actually learn from them first around their experience of when art that they've done, or friends of theirs or peers or people they're inspired by, when art has been effective in changing how people feel. Because when we change how we feel, then it can start to change how we think, and that can start to change how we act. And I would just want to learn from them about examples and experiences they've had, and maybe then draw out together in conversation some patterns. And then I guess I would also want to move from that into a discussion around, you know, this sort of maybe some audience mapping, you know, who are the groups in society that the movement, and I'm going to say we as in the movement, needs to reach out to, you know, groups who in flyover towns in the US or Brexit voting communities in the UK or fishing villages in Italy, or, you know, maybe former coal mining towns in Germany, or all sorts of, you know, communities that the current economic system is not working for. But at the moment, and this is a sweeping statement, but I think it's probably largely true, the economic change movement is not doing a very good job of reaching out to. And this is a real paradox to me, actually. The social justice credentials of the movement are really strong. We're talking better houses, better job, more control at work, better, more secure livelihoods, better transport, better, you know, all sorts of things, better public services. And yet that message isn't really being communicated with those communities who know that the economic system's not working for them, and who is reaching out very effectively to those communities, you know, often openly fascist agitators who don't give a stuff about their livelihoods or their jobs or their, but genuinely, but offer really simple prescriptions for an in-group and sunny uplands for that in-group. And so I'd really want to have a conversation and I don't have the answers here, but I want to have a dialogue with the potential discussion you're describing, to think with artists, well, what medium might they listen to? Is it billboards? Is it TikTok? Is it graffiti on a bridge, you know, in a particular town? Is it a cool mural on that bridge? Is it a sculpture? Is it cartoon? Is it a sort of, there's a really hilarious satirical newspaper that a lot of people follow here in Australia called the Batuta Advocate. Is it something like that? You know, a satire. So I'd really want to map out what are the channels where we can reach and meet those different audiences where they are. So that's would be the sort of way I'd want to open up that conversation and very much learn from them first and foremost.
You started off talking about the material conditions to allow artists to produce art and engage in a world that has really shut them off and disencouraged in so many ways artists to be artists, right? What is the life of an artist like in a well-being economy? If we got all of these policies in place that we so hope for, what would that life look like?
I think there'd be people who made a living very comfortably and without insecurity of their livelihood in a well-being economy, because there were one collective provision to take care of their livelihood, but also because probably a whole ton of enterprises really recognize the value and relevance of art to their enterprise. So the nature of the contract with society or with individual organizations, I think I'd hope would be much more secure and more generous and I'd hope it would feel less precarious for a lot of artists, and I hope there wouldn't be a sense of trade-off between pursuing their craft and financial security, because we know how poisonous financial insecurity can be on people. I think also I'd love to think that there would be more artists, purely because more people had time, that they weren't having to do three jobs on minimum wage to put food on the table, and so don't have time to dabble with, you know, some drawings when they got home, or, you know, just the idea that if maybe, you know, work-life balance could be achieved by more people, then more people would have time to pursue art themselves and more people would have time to enjoy art as well. I hope that's part of an answer. I'd love to see more artists, but also more financially secure artists. And I think there's various ways that can happen.
We had an interesting conversation about what escapism does for our world. And there's two arguments. One is art that allows human beings to be by themselves in a space that feels safe and where they can have an experience that is all about the moment and the being there and the cherishing life, is a thing that keeps us from consuming, from polluting, is a thing that is at its heart a well-being economy endeavor, as it were, or an activity. So in that sense, art that allows us to escape from the present is good for the purposes of what we're hoping to achieve. But then again, there's the other side, where escapism allows us to flee from the problems and not face them. And my favorite example is the detective show. We have the problem and the darkness and the death, let's say, because a murder has been committed, and then the detective puts everything right. And at the end of the show, we can all go to bed thinking the world is back in order. And that's exactly the opposite message. So I was wondering how you felt about escapism, if that's the right word even for both of those facets of what we're talking about.
I love that question. And it's a sort of question I'll probably have more things to say on it in the coming days as it sort of sits in the back of my mind and percolates. But I think you're very right to identify that the two dimensions or almost the paradox, the need for consumerism and the buzz of which is a very real buzz of novelty that people get. You know, our brains are set up in a way that different hormones go off and you know, make us happy when we're consuming because of the novelty of something new. And then, of course, that wears away and we need something new again and again. And I was trying to think, when do people get the sort of hairs on the back of their neck feeling? What are those moments that we can cultivate as an alternative to going out and having the buzz of novelty? And I was thinking, for me, I mean, I can't sing, right? So I'm really crappy singer. But every so often, if I've gone, say, to, you know, been in a choir or, you know, say, gone to church on Christmas morning, and when people are singing carols, I get emotional. I start tearing up. I can't hear some of the Christmas carols without, you know, tears pouring down my face. And I get that hairs on the back of my neck. It's also being in a sporting crowd too, that sort of buzz, you know, and for different people, it'll be different things, you know, fun runs. You can see the rise of the park run in many, many countries around the world. And that's a really nice collective activity that people get a lot of buzz out of. So I think art, particularly when it's done together, could be a really nice alternative to consumerism, to give people that buzz that they quite naturally need. But I also hearing, you know, when you use that word escapism, I could feel that. I could feel my reaction in my stomach, Martin, because my God, I would love to just for a day completely switch off to the environmental breakdown our world is facing and the incredible conflict that the world is suffering right now. But I can't imagine being able to do that totally. And even the idea of wanting to do it for more than just a sort of recharge, take a breath, you know, rejuvenate yourself, I'm not sure. That to me would feel very incredibly self-indulgent. And I don't want to sort of say like I'm any sort of hero. I just cannot imagine being able to switch off from what's going on in the world so much, so totally, that you actually have that real, and even wanting to, because it's so enormous and so present. So the term that I know, and I guess I really envy people who do, you know, I look at some jobs that people are doing, and I thought, my gosh, wouldn't it be amazing to do that job? Because you wouldn't have, I mean, of course, we'd still have to think about what's going on in the world, but that's only because you cared as a citizen. I don't know where I'm going with that, but I really, the idea of escapism, we don't have the luxury of that right now, particularly people who are privileged enough to, I mean, everyone has agency, but because of the way the world is structured, some people have more agency than others. And everyone has a contribution to play. But, you know, I think, you know, those of us in the movement, and particularly those of us who are lucky to earn a crust doing this sort of work, yeah, maybe you need to switch off for a bit, but I just can't imagine ever being able to. So, yeah, that's hence this sort of physical reaction in my tummy when you use that word. I'm a bit, it makes me partially envious, but partially like, no way, we can't do that. Not now, not till it's sorted, you know?
Yeah. So if you were to give this year of 2023, if you were to give it a title as an art piece, so if 2023 were a song, a painting, a book, a play, what would you title it?
You know what comes to mind? You might have to censor this. I don't know if it's an Australian term. The clusterfuck monologues. I mean, honestly.
Clusterfuck monologues? No one is going to top that.
It's really good.
But because, I mean, I think one, that's it's honest about the state the world is in. But two, monologues, because I think, and I'm riffing off the vagina monologues, you know, the play. But monologues, because I think, and it speaks to what I was saying earlier about the movement clearly isn't reaching out to a wide enough audience. It's good at speaking to itself and critiquing itself. It speaks to, I think, people's sense of polarization as well. And, you know, people having monologues with each other rather than dialogue and dancing together.
Thank you for listening. Express Change is supported by the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, the leading collaboration of organizations, alliances, movements, and individuals working to transform the economic system. Find out more at weall.org.
Express Change is produced and edited by Martin Oetting in collaboration with Marina Gattas and the team at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance. You can find out more about my work at martinoetting.com. That's Martin, OETTING.com.